C1A. Number 29A.
Now, I want to touch another point again, namely the question of order. You know that science is defined as a knowledge of factors which are related to each other. That a knowledge of thousands of truths which are unrelated to one another. That knowledge is not considered to be science. Science is only then, or knowledge is only then considered to be scientific knowledge when the factors and the facts which are analyzed are seen and understood in their reciprocal relationship. And you know very well from your experience that only when one begins to see the relationship of factors that new facts and new discoveries are possible. In other words, that revelation really only sets in on the basis of science. That's what Mrs. Jedi brings out so clearly in her textbook, that she always says that science reveals is not something else that can reveal something. The science reveals. A science is knowledge which relies on facts understood in their relationship. And what Mr. Dawley brought out as one of his main theses, so to say, was to show that the synonymous terms are in definite order, and that really only when we see the synonymous terms in their order, that we begin to appreciate them as science. And so I have always put a lot of weight on seeing in the subject and in the subtone the developing sequence of the text. I put those questions there time and time again, perhaps without saying much about them and without pointing out too distinctly this developing order. But we must gently, step by step, acquaint ourselves with that order. First with the word order, mainly on the word order. We must see, if we want to see the subject of science, we must see how Mrs. Eddy always developed a subject from its fundamental proposition in mind, through its development in spirit, through its identification in soul, up to the point of love where we always find the solution to the fundamental proposition. Now, I want one to take this slowly, the seventh subject of prayer, and show how impossible it is to have those seven subjects in prayer in a different order. Or in other words, how that order which she gives is irresistible in its spiritual signification. She starts with the first prayer where we have seen that first she puts proposition before us that we have to seek God as he is. In other words, she first gives the true proposition of what God is and asks us first to have a knowledge of this proposition of God. Seek what God is. If she wouldn't start with that, if in our treatment, if in our solving any problem, we wouldn't start with this first proposition, with a seeking and knowing of God as he is, we certainly would build on ignorance. By what's the use of building on ignorance? So we can see quite clearly there is nothing academical about it, but something very lovingly logical about it, that the first thing is see God as he is and to learn to know God as he is. Else we start with it. Then comes the second subject. Says, well, without knowing really the true object first, we would worship blindly. How could we have a worship and a loving and a gratitude for this God if that God would not be known to us, if it would be a blind God? or if our knowledge of this God would be blind, then we would have what one usually has, that we worship good and evil. We wouldn't be able to worship good. We would worship something which we don't know if it is good or evil. And we may believe that we worship something good, but it may be the very evil we were. So we can see quite easily that before we worship, that before we pray to a God, we first must know. That's the first. And only as we begin to know God as He is, have a true, fine, divine object, that only then we can safely put our heart into effect substance, devote ourselves to that substance, put our heart, our love into it, our affection into it. All that came in the second subject. So we go further to the third. In the third, how could we rebuke sin? The third prayer was the prayer of reformation through the rebuking of sin. How could we rebuke sin? And how can we really rebuke sin? We can only rebuke it through true worship, through the good that has been strengthened in us. That is, only through the strength of good. See, if we would try to rebuke without the first and second step, we wouldn't first of all know what sin is. We wouldn't know it, because the first subject has first to tell us what God is, and therefore the counterfeit of his sin. And second, we wouldn't have the strength to rebuke it, because we can only rebuke things through something very positive. Through our love and worship which we have for the good, we can rebuke things. If we try to rebuke sin without having first a love for the good, what we do is a moral effort, a moral will. A will would be willpower and self-will. We would then try to meet sin in us through willpower, through self-will, but never through something positive, namely through the good in us. Let the good in us be so strong that it can handle sin in us. And so we begin to appreciate really that first subject, because it becomes so tender, is no more such a heroic struggle with sin. If it is built on second step, on the second stage, on the second prayer really, there we have nurtured in us the good, that we have worshipping the good, loving the good, adoring the good, be grateful for the good, so that the good has been strengthened and strengthened in us, as it shows in that second such. Then the good in us takes care of the evil in us, and it has then in itself the power to oust out the sin in us. Then we come to the fourth. The fourth has shown that only as we rebuke things, and only as we have rebuked things, can we conform God's requirements, can we have a principled attitude. So often we would like to take a principled attitude. But what is a principled attitude? A principled attitude is that attitude where I am one with principle. But how can I be one with principle as long as there is something between principle and me? Sin is always the belief that there is a separation between God and man. And as long as I have that sense that there is something in me which is separate from God and separates me from God, I can never be one with God. Quite impossible. And therefore, if I take that fourth point without the third, then I become a hypocrite. That's what he says, that then we become involuntary hypocrites. Because then we have somehow to show outwardly this a sense of correlation with principle. But inwardly, we are not. We are like white receptacles, he says there. So we can't start with a principled attitude. So the principled attitude is more than words. It is an inward attitude. And that inward attitude consists of, first, that I begin to know God as He is. Second, that becomes my substance. And third, that substance is so pure and so strong that it begins to oust sin out of me. And as that goes out of me and nothing is anymore between God and me, then I reach fourth stage, only then of coincidence of principle and idea, of correlation of principle and idea, of correspondence of principle And I can see very easily that only at that point, when I reach that point, that I begin to experience new life, the fifth day. Because only then principle can sound through me. Only then principle has a free way to sound through me. Then it is no more obstructed. There is no more obstruction of life, no more an obstruction through ignorance or materiality or sin or personal sin. All that, those obstructions are out of the way. And only then can principle have his way. And only then I can no more have my way. And so I come to the fifth prayer, where principle begins sound through a situation in a principled way and no more in a personal way. And only then in the sixth hand can the sixth stage, the stage of men who have that prayer of affirmation of truth, which has brought their wholeness of manhood. Remember that in that sixth prayer came in for the first time the wholeness of manhood. I begin to realize in myself the wholeness of manhood only then, when life, fatherhood of God, is working. Man, the new man, can come to birth only when the fatherhood of God is expressing himself. How can I have a new sense of man, a more living sense of man, unless it rests on life? There is no newness of manhood without the newness of life. And so, you see, the days of creation have shown that time and time again, that only the sixth day man comes into folk, that the true man, the only man, the real man, comes into focus the moment we have reached the fifth day of life and let life express the divine principle. And then, lastly, in the seventh, we begin only as we begin to see that we are the manifestation of the one Father. Only as we begin to see that in the measure as I go to life, I am man. In the measure as I'm going to Father, I am Son. Only in that measure as that Son begins to be born in me, then the seventh prayer comes into focus, namely that it opens up the infinite possibility, that it opens up that world which is rich, vast and wide and far off. You know, where she said, I always like that introduction. He said, Christian rejoice in secret beauty and bounty, hidden from the world, but known to God. Such a vast, wide realm that then is open. And so we have only that seventh day, and the realization of that seventh day is the first 6 days are understood, loved, and grasped to a certain extent. I'm very keen, I must say, I'm very on this point of seeing the irresistible order of sense. And I think we spend our time well if we go through it every day and ask oneself every day, why is this order irresistible? Because the more we consider that irresistible order of the world, the more we embody naturally the world. The more we imbibe the word and embody them for the word and become the embodiment of the inspired word. And then the outcome of it is that there is something natural in us which is able to start naturally with the right proposition of mind and is naturally able to develop that proposition of mind through spirit. And that which naturally becomes natural then as one worships that one base, that something natural in us begins to speak and out the wrong sense of its soul. And as it does that, the more this attitude of mind, spirit, soul becomes one principle, it begins to rule our life. It begins to rule our life. What life? The new life becomes our new life. It begins to rule us in a new way than before. That's the newness of life. And if it begins to rule us in a new way, what is the outcome of it? A new sense of man, a higher sense of man, the sixth day. And in that measure, as a new sense of man is growing constantly and every day on us, the more I begin to see the seventh day, that infinite possibilities of love, the infinite variety of love, the infinite vastness of the world of love. Can I repeat that all again? Yeah? It's so simple, but science must be simple. I think I told you last time that sometimes I have a bit difficulty in repeating these simple statements, because the human mind says, let's have something more now. Let's have something higher now. But I can't feel something higher than that which is deep, and the simple facts are deep. Let's just go over the... You see, there are the 7 days, really, but they are so fundamental. They're always the same, which say, now, start on the right space by guiding your thoughts to the basis of being, to God as He is. In the measure as I begin to see God as He is, I begin to love that. I begin to adore that. The adorable one, that sacred. I begin to adore it, to love it, to worship it. I'm so jolly grateful that He is what He is, and that He that can never be touched by all what's going on with Sputniks and Khrushchev and so on. I'm so jolly happy and grateful for that. And as I begin to be grateful and happy and jolly about that, that grows in me and grows in me, and what it does, it puts out of me what is false. The first, it speaks for itself. Has its representative, soul sense speaks in me, has its representative, and speaks for the truth in me. And out all sinful sense about. These are my three natures of God. Mind, spirit, soul, the nature of God. And in the measure as I love and culture and adore these three, in that measure they begin to rule me. They begin to be my boss, my prince, as the prince. They begin to be the principle of what? My life. They begin to rule me. What rule does it bring? It rules out my own sense of living, my old sense of looking at the world, and brings to me a new sense of life. And as it brings to me a new sense of life, I say to myself, well, I'm jolly well another fellow now. I feel quite different than yesterday, and I feel quite different than a year ago. I think I'm no more the same old boy. I'm a new sense of man. And I see, oh, the new sense of man is being born. It's always being born. And as I begin to feel that, I begin to feel that this new sense of man which is being born is born every day new, and always in a way which I have never thought out, which I could never think out. And I begin to touch a little bit of the infinite possibilities of God and of love, because I could never think out the satisfaction I got. I could never think out the joy which I got. I could never think out the blessings which I got. Who did think that out? That bounty and beauty of divine love hidden from the world, but known to God. That infinite vastness of love which needs every human need. So let's culture those simple tones of sense. And if we culture them, they become natural to us. We embody God. We embody the Word of God. Now let's get on to atonement. And as we do that, I try to do it again by being quite relaxed and just have a little talk on the fireside about this stuff, which I think one of the biggest points we have always to refresh and to remember is that as we go on to a new chapter, it's never adding something new to the old, but that every chapter brings to birth a new aspect of the old, that the new chapter is born, so to say, out of the old. In prayer, we have seen that only that which is mind-like can approach mind. Only that which is spirit-like in us can approach spirit. And the soul-like can approach soul and so on. We saw that we appeal, that the chapter on prayer appeals to the divine in us, not to any sense of lack, not to the human, not to human qualities, not to mortal qualities, not to ritualistic necessities. It appeals to the mind life in us, to the spirit life in us, to the soul life, and the principle life, and the life life, and the truth life, and the love life in us. And as we begin to value that, we begin certainly to have a sense that we have, therefore, everything already in us. We begin to feel that the kingdom of heaven is in us, that we somehow are pregnant with the divine idea, just waiting to develop and develop and develop further and further through every chapter. And atonement and Eucharist comes and says, all right, give birth to that presence. It's not enough that we feel that we have in us the kingdom of heaven, and that kingdom of heaven is able to tap, so to say, the infinite resources of God. Prayer is really a tapping of the infinite resources of God, where we just find out how to turn the tap. But the flow is always there, the infinite source is there, the infinite stream is there, we just have to tap it. And so we come in Atonement and Eucharist to the point where we say, now let's give birth to that Christ Spirit. Let's give birth to what is waiting to unfold and always unfold. And as the obstetric shows, the second step is always to put aside all material conception so that the birth will be natural and safe. And the second chapter does that too. The second chapter comes and says, all right, let that birth go on, and in order that it goes on naturally and safely, let's put all the obstructions out of the way. That's the Eucharist.